Comic Book Time Machine, Episode 19, Manhunter, Number 3, The Gentleman of Japan. As Manhunter No. 2 concluded, Mark Shaw was a fugitive from the law, on the run from an assassin, captured by the Yakuza, and a stranger in a strange land. In Manhunter No. 3, despite all this conflict, Mark Shaw's story takes a backseat and is intertwined with another Shaw who loves justice. To pick up Man No. 3, The Gentleman of Japan, you need to set your time coordinates to May 10, 1988, to pick up the September cover-dated story. The story is again written by John Ostrander and Kim Yale, with pencils by Doug Rice and inks by Sam Keith. The team is all back together in this story that focuses on honor and culture, with only a sprinkling of fighting. The plot. Mark Shaw's in the custody of the Yakuza. Specifically, he has been kidnapped by, or captured by, Ijai Hasaga, Lord of the Dishiduku, or Foremost Poison. Again, I'm not going to worry too much about the fact that I'm going to mispronounce everything. So mock me at will, Ben Avery, because I'm going to mispronounce a ton of Japanese words today. It becomes clear that the Iizuka are not Shaw's enemy but his savior. Ijai Hasaga explains that he has come to Shaw's aid due to the bonds of blood and spirit with Elliot Shaw. He has picked up the fugitive Shaw out of the city, out of the sake of Girinuju. And with Sean Ostrander and Yale's young readers all confused, the Yakuza lord begins his story in post-war Japan. Ijai Hasaga had been a soldier who fought the Americans during World War II. After the conflict, he returned to an occupation Japan that was shattered. There was no Marshall Plan to bolster the starving Japanese and restart the economy. There was little work and skimpy rations, and in this environment, the black market, the Sakuchuna, man, I am killing it, flourished. Fearing the black market was preying on the innocent, Ijai Hasaga declares a personal war against those who profited by this ill-gotten gain. To launch his battle, he placed himself into the service of an Oeban, or father, as the Koeban. Child, as a Koeban, he placed himself fully within the wishes of his Oeban. The loyalty of the relationship is so extreme that a Koeban would lay down his life or face imprisonment in his master's place. This was a choice that would put the ex-soldier on a road towards his high-level standing in the Yakuza. Meanwhile, another former soldier was also assigned to Japan, Elliot Shaw. Shaw served as an aide to Colonel Charles L. Cadis in General Douglas MacArthur's occupation government. One day, Shaw was riding through the streets of Tokyo in a jeep, and as he moved through the streets, he heard a scream. He jumped into an alley and witnessed several Chinese men assaulting a Japanese woman. The leader of the mob insisted that Shaw back away and leave him to his business. Instead, Shaw arrested the gang leader, Chin. Shaw convinced the Japanese victim to testify, though his government superiors did not want him to prosecute Chin. Chin, as a Chinese national, was considered an ally. Additionally, Chin was a member of the the black market. Shaw argues elegantly, "With all due respect, sir, we are here to restore peace and establish laws that will protect all the citizens. The exception of one man from due criminal process means the law is administered not equally for all, but capriciously for the few. My conscience and principles refuse to let this happen, sir." So, Shaw's moral compass wins the day. And he leads the case against Chin, who is convicted thanks to the testimony of his victim. Chin was sentenced to 6 months hard labor, during which he died. For his efforts, Shaw was sent home. As he packed his bags to return to the United States, a Japanese man illegally enters his quarters. The man explains that he was the husband of the assaulted woman and that Shaw's actions saved not only her, but their unborn child. Shaw seems to be dismissive that the man believes that Shaw followed through due to any special circumstances. He makes it clear that if a Japanese mob had insulted a Chinese woman, he would have done the same thing. The man owes Shaw nothing. The Japanese man states that he is shocked that a gaijin understands Kirinuju. Shaw angrily shoots back. Loyalty, compassion, moral obligation, duty. These are American traits as well as Japanese, sir. Shaw leaves angrily after the man attempts to pay him for his services in cold, hard cash. With the money, refused, the man, Ishai Hasakawa, swears to fulfill his debt with future service. Now the Koibon finds himself as an Oibon, as Lord of the Foremost Poison. As the head of the prominent Azuka family, he knows everything that occurs in Sanjikao. And with the younger Shaw in harm's way, it was the perfect opportunity to pay off his debt. He assigns his son Kuzu, the unborn child, and his Koibon to protect Shaw, and the Yakuza agrees to ferry Shaw out of Japan. Though they note once he has returned to the United States, they can no longer stop Dumas. On page 13, Dumas finally hits the page. He confronts Shaw's group at the docks as they attempt to load him onto a ship. Kuzu explains that Shaw is under the protection of Foremost Poison and that this blanket of protection ends at the shores of the United States. Shaw offers his mask again to Dumas, who refuses it because his honor demands Shaw's life. He will have the mask off Shaw's dead body. So, Mark keeps both. Kazao puts Shaw on a slow boat to California. But he makes a change of plan in Taiwan, grabs a new identity, and an airplane home. In the States, Mark goes straight to the man he knows betrayed him, Jamie Shaw. He accuses Jamie of setting him up with the offer to buy his mask in front of his sister and father. Someone at the law firm had to be connected to the subpoena and the offer to buy the Manhunter mask. As Jamie proclaims his innocence and his love of brother, Elliot speaks up. It is he who knows who requested the subpoena, Olivia Bancroft. Bancroft was a legend of smoke. She was a beauty. She was rich. She was desired all throughout the 1930s and 50s. At that time, she exited public life by building herself a house that was a combination of Western Japanese styles in Japan. Japanese styles in Wisconsin, on top of a 100-foot column of rock. She then withdrew to the home for the next 35 years, never leaving. Elliot had met her once as a young man, and like all men during that time, he fell in love with her, even if it was just for an evening. Out of respect for that memory, it is he who took the subpoena and therefore helped set up Mark. Mark recounts how he escaped Japan. Elliot minces no words for his distaste of the Yakuza lord, who is just a criminal. As Mike reunites with Elliot, Jamie, and Sister Eleanor, a call arrives at the office for Mark from the missing member of the Shaw family. Mom. Dumas is in the house. The Shaw clan jumps in their cars and race to their home. In transit, Jamie continues to state his love of brother, and Mark finally puts his mask on. The Shaws all want to help Mom, and they agree to follow Mark's orders. Mark enters the home and mocks Dumas, who threatens to kill him with a gun. Shaw points out that this is an odd choice of weapon for an exotic killer. Dumas mocks back that he would have used Shaw's baton, but it appears to not have a kill setting. Then Jamie crashes through the window earlier than planned, and fighty-fighty-fighty breaks out. In the tussle, Jamie is shot. Eleanor shoots at Dumas in return, and Dumas frees. We know that this is true as Mark's mass sensors confirm that Dumas has left the area. Thank you for dialogue that's needed. Though Dumas is gone, Mark understands the risk. Dumas will kill everyone he loves to get to him. Jamie is already injured. Yes, as the teaser of the next issue announces, the final confrontation is in the works. Elliot Shaw really is the star of this issue. Honestly, there's more Elliot Shaw than Mark Shaw, and there's even less Manhunter. We learn a lot about the elder Shaw, a remarkable lot when you consider he's just a supporting character. In fact, there's more of his life through flashback than typical superhero fighty-fighty on the page. Elliot Shaw is a man with high morals. He supports and believes in the rule of law for all men and women, regardless of race or social position. Shaw costs himself a key position in the occupation government in prosecuting Chin. His career may have been stalled some as he returned from Japan in, quote-unquote, disgrace. A reader can see Mark Shaw and his motivation in Elliot Shaw's story. Both crave justice. You get the sense that Elliot Shaw helped build the man and hero that Mark became. Mark's love of justice clearly comes from Elliot, and we can easily picture the Shaw family sitting around debating legal ethics over the Thanksgiving table as Shaw taught his children the difference between right and wrong. Yes, Elliot Shaw helped make Mark the man he became and perhaps even made him open to the teachings of the Manhunter cult, where a love of justice was twisted into evil. Another aspect of Elliot Shaw's clear distinction between right and wrong is his disdain of the accuser lord. As a young man, he acted because it was right. It was not out of consideration for helping the Japanese man's war against the foreign black market. A woman was assaulted, and the wrongdoer had to be tried in court. As older men, Shaw sees his Japanese counterpart for what he is, a criminal. Despite the bonds of blood and spirit, this is a one-way allegiance. Elliot Shaw wanted nothing from the Lord of the Foremost Poison as young men, and he still feels the same as respected older men. You get the feeling? No, you know for a fact that for Elliot Shaw, their history means nothing. But history is something that Elliot Shaw does respect. He did unintentionally set up his son out of the memory of a flame he carried for Olivia Bancroft. And he admits he was the one involved in setting up Mark. Other than pleasing a lady who once winked at him, I'm not sure fully what Shaw's motivation was. Maybe it made him feel young again to be involved with the beauty. One member of the Shaw's family has had a name change. The very stoic-sounding James Shaw has been transformed in the last two issues to the super fun Jamie Shaw! Okay, he still looks bookish with his glasses and close-cut hair. But I will say for some reason, I feel more endearment for this lawyer, with him having a softer-sounding name. Now, this change to Jamie could also be showing us a less former atmosphere around the Shaw brothers than we saw in the first issue. Now, we just need to ask when Eleanor will become Ellie. In the late 1980s, this story with showing the impact of World War II was still very topical. It is important to remember that events do leave a huge footprint, especially in days without instant news. Movies like Patton, Midway, A Bridge Too Far, and Tora 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 were being played late night and weekends on television, and would have been on heavy rotation on the growing number of cable stations. These movies were made by those who lived during the conflict, and then was watched by their children and grandchildren. And the greatest generation was coming into retirement age, or was in retirement age during that time. I can remember my own grandmother, for who the war left a lasting impression on her shopping habits, and I can remember my father talked to me about my grandparents' wartime production jobs. One of them worked at the Martin B-26 Marauder Assembly Plant in Omaha, Nebraska. Sorry, I don't remember which one. It might have been two grandparents. So despite the fact that I was a youngster, World War II still felt topical in a way that for my own kids will never be true. And I will say, despite this being a funny book, the topic of the very real World War II and its legacy would have been a very adult topic that would have kept the interest of older readers. Ostrander and Yale liberally used facts about post-war Japan to weave Elliot Shaw's tale. Elliot Shaw serves on the staff of Colonel Charles Lewis Caddis. Caddis was an Army reservist who had fought in Europe and was transferred to the Pacific as a member of the General Headquarters Government Section under MacArthur's command. Caddis is widely considered the architect of the Japanese Constitution, which established the emperor as the Japanese head of state, renounced Japan's right to war, and an offensive military force, along with abolishing the Japanese feudal system. After his service in Japan, he returned to a private law practice, much like Elliot Shaw. And the term Seigokujin, which I murder constantly, was one that appeared in occupation Japan for ex-colonial nationals, just as those originally from Korea and China. And many impoverished Seigokujin turned into a life of crime, including black market activities. The character of Chin is very much grounded in the real history of Japan. The story of Elliot Shaw feels true because it has a basis in reality. And the images help reinforce the reality. I love Rice's depiction of Shaw's driver, Purcell. In one glimpse of this haggard young man, you see a man beaten down by war, but while also lacking the experience and morals of Shaw. The image speaks, and Purcell does not have to. And when he does, the image reinforces his bigoted attitude. When I was growing up in the Midwest, there was a billboard near my home advertising the House of the Rock for several years. And though I never visited this Wisconsin attraction, which seemed like light years away, it was very much the story of the Bancroft House. The House on the Rock was built on top of a column of rock in Wisconsin in the 1950s, and it was opened to the public in 1959. The house is very eclectic with a number of design influences, including Frank Lloyd Wright's work and Japanese architecture. However, unlike the Vancroft House, since 1959, this house has been opened by its builder, Alex Jordan Jr., to the general public, allowing the public to tour the home and tour the numerous collections in the home, such as the world's largest indoor carousel, a room full of music machines, and various other antiques. The House of the Rock is reported to be one of the most popular, if not the most popular, Wisconsin tourist destination. In many ways, the story of the Vancroft House is the story of the House on the Rock, with an added recluse. And the Ostrander and Yale continue to show how to ground a story grafting together the story of occupation, Japan, and Wisconsin tourist traps. I've really come to appreciate how well Ostrander uses history and fiction. For another example, see the Relatively Geeky Network and Michael Bailey's coverage of Ostrander's The Kents. Ostrander and Yale also taps into Japanese criminal culture. The Yakuza, as we have described, is broken into a hierarchical system with an oyabun, or foster parent, having koibun, or foster children, swearing allegiance. As rice draws out, the relationship is sealed by a ceremony where a single cup of sake is shared, and in many ways this oyabun-koibun relationship seems like the Eastern version of the Roman patriot-client relationship, where a less powerful individual pledges allegiance to a powerful patron. In the Italian setting, this is the foundation of the mafia hierarchy, with the patron becoming the Don, as seen in The Godfather. So we should not be surprised that Oeban can also be translated as the equivalent of a mafia Don. Now, Giri Niju is a more complicated concept. Giri would translate as obligation, and Niju would mean compassion or empathy. And often in Japanese literature, this is the center of story conflicts, as in a character has to balance what they must do with their own human emotions. And I know I'm really explaining this poorly. From this story in Eliot's speech, I get the sense that Eliot is saying the concept is the obligation to behave with honor and compassion. And this would align with Eliot's view of justice, doing the right thing. But again, I'm not sure that that is what is meant in traditional Japanese culture, really being shown on the page. Or I could just be really, really dense. As I mentioned with issue one, issue two, this arc really impacted my views of modern Japan, and I do think I was given too much, and I don't think I was given too much wrong information for the sake of the story. You know what's missing from this issue, and I really missed it? Ostrander and Yale did not provide us any commentary. With no wisdom shared, seriously, Ostrander has been deep on these pages. I do not have as much to say. I feel like I have been getting a masterclass on story development and insight into the human mind. But this issue, we do not get to sit at the feet of the sage. Well, it's coming, friends. It's coming, time travelers. It's happening. Get your batons out. Because in the next Manhunter episode, we dive into Manhunter number 4 and the final confrontation. But will it be a lot of fighty, fighty, fighty? Or will we continue to entertain while we learn? Remember, you can always find us at comicbooktimemachine.com. You can find Ben and I talking about the Marvel Cinematic Universe at welcometolevel7.com with the 7 spelled out. And you can follow my Disney writings at betweendisney.com. Good luck, kids. Make good choices.